Probably there's no better way to study the Bible than to study it inductively in a chapter-by-chapter, verse-by-verse progress through a book. And in the study of Ecclesiastes, this is probably becomes very apparent because it's a confusing book. But when you stay with the text of the book and are confronted again and again with the attitudes of Solomon and the information he's sharing, you begin to understand the nature of this book, and some of the conflict that it presents with other scripture begins to clear up, I feel. Okay, in chapter 8 he opens the book by saying, "Who is as the wise men?" And the word "as" means like. Who is like the wise men? Now, we have seen throughout this book of Ecclesiastes that Solomon has struggled with the virtues and the values of wisdom. It is wisdom under the sun. It is wisdom from human viewpoint. And he struggled with the values of that as opposed to the values of materialism, of folly, and of hedonism. And throughout the book, he comes to confusing conclusions about these values. For example, if we are on chapter 8, and he is saying, "Who is like the wise man?" Or, "Who is as the wise man?" Now, this wise man, you see, is a theme of the book, one of the themes. Now, let's go back and pick up just a few of the statements that he makes about wisdom. And particularly, we want to remember that this is wisdom under the sun, and the confusing conclusions that he comes to. For example, in chapter 1 and verse 13, we read this. I'll read verse 12 also. "I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and to search out wisdom," or "to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail that God hath given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith." In other words, he said, "I am going to observe the struggle that all men experience in life, and I'm going to seek out the wisdom, by wisdom, the meaning of that." Now, you have to compare with that verse 14. In verse 14, he tells us his conclusion. "I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity." And vanity in the book means futility, emptiness, meaninglessness. All is meaningless. All is vexation of spirit, or striving after the wind. In verse 17 of chapter 1, again he mentions this striving after wisdom. "I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that this also is vexation of the spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow." In chapter 2, in verse 12 and 13, he makes another comparison relative to wisdom. "I turned myself, or I made a reversal in my mind, to behold or to consider wisdom, and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which has already been done? Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly, as light, or as far as light, excelleth darkness." In other words, it's better to be wise than to be a fool. But there really isn't too much advantage, he's going to tell us in verse 15, because both of them have, a wise person and a fool has the same fate. And his concern then becomes how to have fun in life. Look at verse 15 of the second chapter. "Then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me." And he was more wise than the fool. And then he says, "And why was I then more wise? What good was it to be more wise? Then I said in my heart, this is also futility." He just keeps coming back to this same problem of meaninglessness, of futility in life. But he does see a little more virtue in being wise than in acting out of wisdom, on the basis of wisdom, than on acting on the basis of folly. The thing that hangs him up is the problem of death. Well, let's go back to chapter 8. Why is he asking the question as to who is like the wise man? Well, he's asking this question in view of the problem of despotism and following leaders in government that is a very necessary concept of life, to keep order in life. So what he's going to deal with in chapter 8, we're going to have two paragraphs. And the first paragraph comprises verses 1 through 9. And in that section, he's dealing with, he's going to give advice. This is Solomon's advice on wise conduct under despotism. Okay. And he's going to sort of eulogize the wise person. The wise person, he feels, will act rightly under despotism. All right, let's go through verse 1. Who is like the wise man? And who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? That is, who knows the interpretation or the true meaning of a thing like a wise man would know it? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine. It affects his countenance. And the boldness of his face shall be changed. Now, the word boldness in verse 1 means lack of bashfulness. This is what it literally means. I tried to think of a word for that and I couldn't. Should have looked it up in my book of synonyms. This word then comes to mean hardness. It means impudence. Now he says, a wise person will not have a look of impudence on his face. He will not have a hard look. His wisdom will affect his countenance. Now, verse 2, he begins to move into the area that he is interested in relative to the exercise of this person's wisdom. Verse 2 is an exhortation. I counsel you to keep the king's commandment, and that in regard of the oath of God. In other words, he's saying in verse 2, be loyal to the king. Observe the king's commandment and do it because of your responsibility under God to rulers. In other words, this is sort of an Old Testament reaffirmation of the advice of Paul in Romans 13, that the powers that be are ordained of God. Now, the problem is that the king may be a despot. And in Oriental times, all kings were despots. Their word was law. It was like Solomon. This is one of the things that makes the Song of Solomon such an exciting book. Because as an Oriental despot, if he wanted the woman to be his wife, he could force her to be his wife. He could just say the word. And his word was law. And so Solomon is expressing himself within that context, the context of Oriental despotism, the fact that what the king says is law. Now, the principle runs true, that human beings in ancient times and in modern times are responsible to those who are ruling them, so that all the prophets will condemn any breach of obedience of Israelites when they are under the yoke of a foreign oppressor, when they're under Assyria, or when they're under the Chaldean Empire. The prophets will tell them, you can't lift your hand against that yoke. Daniel, Nehemiah, Mordecai, they all act in conformity with the principle that the powers that be were ordained of God. So verse 2 is an exhortation. Now in verse 3, you have a warning corresponding to the exhortation. So it reads this way. There are two clauses. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. And the idea there is do not get in a hurry to go away from him, either in your loyalty or in your planning. The second clause says, stand not in an evil thing. That is, do not join in, do not take your stance, do not take your position in an evil thing. And the idea would be probably some rebellion against the king in this matter. Don't do this, for he, the king, doeth whatever pleaseth him. Verse 4. Where the word of the king is, there is power. And who may say unto the king, what doest thou? Again, all from a standpoint of Oriental despotism. Now in verse 5, he begins to give us some rationale for this. Whoso keepeth the commandment. Now you ought to write yourself a note there in verse 5. That commandment is the commandment of the king that's referred to in verse 2. So the idea would be, whosoever keepeth the king's commandment, not shall feel, but shall experience, or shall know, no evil thing. Now there is the sort of a basic assumption that the Oriental king will be ruling for the good of his people. And he will not do an evil thing if they are obedient to his law. Okay? And a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. Now, how does that fit? Now, watch. The logic is this. A wise man is going to act in a certain way. He's going to think through. He's not going to have a hardness about him. And he knows that the king is in authority by divine decree. And so he will be obedient to the king's laws. Now, advice in view of that. Make sure you do not line up on some rebellious side. For the king, he has authority, he has power. Who's going to say to him, what are you doing? If you keep his commandments, you will not have to fear evil. Nothing will come upon you. And then he says, and a wise man's heart discerneth time and judgment. Now again he's back, you see, in verse 5 to the wise man. Now the word discerneth there means to know. And in the B clause it reads like this. A wise man's heart knows a time and a judgment. Time is the word eth, and a mishpat. Mishpat usually means a right judgment, to make a right decision. Now we have to keep this in the context. The time that is spoken of here, that the wise man anticipates, is a terminus, an end. Now, in most commentaries, they argue about what the terminus is too. I think there's two possibilities to what this end is. It is a terminus, an end, to wrong. There's no question about that. But who is the perpetrator of the wrong? Is it the citizen of the state, or is it the despotic king? He's going to make reference to a despot king. Down in verse 9, at the end, he says, there is a time, and if, wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt, a tyrant king. Well, a wise man knows that there is a terminus, an end, to wrong, no matter who is responsible. And the idea would be whether the wrong comes from the king, whether the wrong from a tyrant, or whether wrong from a evil person, a citizen. And a wise person knows that that evil that is being done will come to an end. God won't permit it to continue. He also knows that there will be a judgment, a mishpat. The judgment means a judicial decision. A judicial decision. And that means what to do in the matter. In other words, the right and the wrong, or the righting of the wrong. That time will come. So what are you saying? A wise man knows a time and a judgment, and the idea is a wise person knows these will not fail. These will not fail. They have to come. Now, if you were to go down through the course of history and trace the decline of civilizations, like Toynbee has done, some 23 civilizations, like Oswald Spengler did in The Decline of the West, you find that the degeneration sets in on a civilization, and there is evil that is going on in the degeneration. And it is only a matter of time, there's only a course of time when a judgment will be rendered on that, and generally that civilization will end. The same thing is true with administrations. Witness some of the things that happened in the Kennedy administration that are now coming to light, and the effect that that would have if it had been known in the Kennedy administration. But it is now coming to light. Witness the Nixon administration. There was a time and a judgment when those things had to stop that were going on, you see. A wise person knows that that's going to happen. Okay, so a wise person is biding his time under those circumstances. Now, verse 6 is going to reinforce that interpretation. And you notice that it begins with this causal statement. Because to every purpose there is a time and a judgment. The same expression that you have in the previous verse. Okay. The Amplified translates this, for every purpose and matter has its right time and judgment. Judgment will be rendered upon the situation that is going on. Okay? Now, rather than the therefore, though, it'd be better to translate this adverbial particle, although the misery of man is great upon him. Now, what does that mean? Well, if we translate the word misery, 6b should be translated this way, although the wickedness of man is great upon him. The King James translates this word wrath. R-A, as misery in this passage. Much better translated misery. You have another derivative of this word down in verse 8, where it says, neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. In other words, the idea in verse 6b is a rationale for verse 5. And the concept would be this. A despot's or a tyrant's evil will be upon him. On the other hand, if the evil is a matter of a rebel, then a rebel's evil will be upon him. And there'll be a time and a judgment when that will be brought to light. Okay. Now, verses 7 and 8 explain the rationale. Now watch the rationale. The rationale comes in areas that man cannot control or cannot know. Verse 7. For, or we could translate because. Because he knoweth not that which shall be. Okay. Verse 7 and 8. The rationale. Who is the he? First point of the rationale. Because he knoweth not that which shall be. Now, as I worked on this today, I couldn't help but think about Richard Nixon in this, whether you want to call it a setup he was in or what. He won an election by the most overwhelming vote that there's ever been in an election in the United States. And that election was a mandate, not so much for Richard Nixon, but against George McGovern. The American people were saying, we do not want George McGovern to be our president when they put Richard Nixon in office. And it was an overwhelming vote. There has never been a landslide election like that, to that effect. And my interpretation was, it wasn't so much that I didn't vote for him. I voted for Schmitz. I don't even remember his name. Who does? Somebody asked him one time if his real name was Schmidt or Smith. And he says, well, it really was Smith. But when I got married, the night I got married, I went to a motel. He says, I was embarrassed to sign the name Smith, so I signed it Schmidt. And he says, I've been using that name ever since. His platform was 8 hours pay for 8 hours work. I said, you got my vote. So you see, there's nothing, you know, personally involved with my making these statements. Now, who would have known that the wheels were in motion at the time that would unseat Richard Nixon? Who would have known? Who would have predicted that? Now, I told the board of this church that the minute that the information was out, I said, he's done. It is just a matter of time, he's done. He's finished. He can't be the president of the United States. I think it took a year and a half after that for him to be put out of office. So I'm not going to make reference to Richard Nixon in either of these contexts, but the same thing is true is what of this person who is executing evil in this passage, the person who's executing wickedness, whether it's the leader or whether it's the other person. They cannot predict what is going to happen in the future. And in the struggle of politics, if anybody knows that, anything could happen there. So number one reason for this is, this time is coming, this F is coming, this judgment is coming, because these people involved cannot predict what's going to happen in the future. There may be somebody else struggling for power that's going to get their hands on the information, and once they do, off goes the head. Okay? The second reason that's given in verse 7. For who can tell him when it shall be? Let's assume you know something is going to happen, but you don't know when it's going to happen. Okay, so the next point is, man cannot predict with finality when something will happen. Man cannot predict with finality when something will happen. Okay? And here is an Oriental king who knows all the intrigues of court life. He knows a lot of the evil of it. He's going to almost experience a rebellion by his own son. Okay, in verse 8 he continues to tell us some things that man cannot know or do. There is no man that hath power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. Verse 3. Now in the context, there is, let's put it this way, he cannot control the wind. The word Spirit is the word ruach in Hebrew, just like the word pneuma in Greek means either spirit or wind or breath. Okay? Now, it's possible that the writer is talking about the breath of life here, and the idea then would be, or he cannot control the breath of life. That is, in a natural situation, he does not have control over the breath of life. He cannot give the breath of life in a natural situation, nor can he take the breath away in a natural situation. It has to be an unnatural situation. Murder or something like that, yes, but not in a natural situation. The second thing that he could not control in verse 8 is, neither hath he power in the day of death. That is, he cannot control the moment of death under a natural situation. He cannot control the moment of death in a natural situation. Now, it's true that he could commit murder or he could commit suicide. But the author's not talking about that. He's talking about the natural situation. This is natural physical death. I wrote on my paper here a big question mark. Would Solomon be able to say that today with the concept of either life-preserving systems or death-prolonging systems? The struggle over euthanasia. What are we doing in the situation? Are we preserving life? Or are we prolonging death? Very, very difficult situation. And doctors make judgments every day relative to preserving life or prolonging death. Those are moral judgments that doctors have to make every day. Very, very difficult situation that they're in. Well, Solomon is saying, under any normal situation, the moment of death cannot be controlled by man. Okay? Now, the King James says for the third thing that man cannot control, the fifth thing here in our logic, is there is no discharge. King James says in that war, that's not quite what it says. It really says there is no furlough in war. So under a normal situation, in ancient times, he cannot control the ancient citizen. Could not control furlough discharge in war. You know, the day before battle, he decides he'd take a 3-day pass. No way in ancient times. He was under the command of the king, and the king's word was law. And when the king said attack, they attacked, even though they were going to a sure death. That's the way it was. So he's speaking from that viewpoint of an Oriental despot, you see. And under normal circumstances, no person could control these things. It was absolute. The last thing that is out of the control of man's hands is a fantastic statement. It's a good statement. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. And the word deliver means to save or to liberate, to give deliverance. It is the word melat. And melat means to, and it's in a causative spin. Wickedness can never cause anybody to be delivered to those that are given to it. So here he switches now from a subject. The subject now becomes wickedness. See, here the subject has been man. Now the subject is wickedness. Wickedness cannot save. And the concept of save means cause to be saved, malat, which means deliver. Wickedness cannot deliver. Wickedness cannot preserve. There is a basic destructive trend to wickedness. It cannot deliver, it cannot save its adherents. Okay. So this reaffirms, you see, the interpretation that the wicked will have a time and a mishpat. And it doesn't matter if a king is a despot or a tyrant, he's going to have his time and his judgment. And it doesn't matter who is perpetrating the wickedness, that person will have its time and its judgment. Okay? Now in verse 9, he comes to a conclusion. All this have I seen, and I applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. And there is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. He's a tyrant. Okay, now that takes us to the end of that paragraph. And the subject of that paragraph, we said, was Solomon's advice in all the situation that he sees in his day, sort of advice relative to enduring evil, even evil perhaps that comes from a despotic king. Now in paragraph number 2, which runs from chapter 8, or in chapter 8 from verse 10 to verse 15, I guess we could run it to the end. Let's just run it to the end because he comes to a conclusion that is very exciting in verse 17. The theme of this is, again, we're back now. He retrogresses right back into that negative vein that he gets in. The wicked and the righteous. The wicked and, we'll call them the plus R, experience the same happenings in life. Therefore, this is going to be his conclusion. There is little satisfaction. There is little satisfaction for man beyond eating and drinking and merriment. Now that's sort of his struggle in the book. You know, how to be happy. Sort of the same thing everybody wrestles with. These are the fruit of his labor. So he goes back to that old conclusion that he has repeated probably 5 times in the book. Let's look at the passage. I don't think the thought is too hard here to follow, so just follow along with me. And so I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of the holy, or the holy place, meaning they went to the temple that he had built. And they came and they went, and they came and they went. But they were basically wicked people. And they were forgotten in the city where they had so done, and this is futility. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, now he comes up with sort of a proverb, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. And simply saying in verse 11, no speedy trial equals more crime. Correct. Verse 12. Though a sinner do evil in 100 times, and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with him, well with them that fear God, which fear before him. In other words, you may know somebody who's very much involved in sin, and yet he lives a long life. And you may say, well, he's having more fun than I am. Maybe I should be involved in him. Solomon is saying, no. Your reverential respect for God is going to stand you in good. Verse 13. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not. He doesn't have reverential trust with God. There is a vanity which is done on the earth. There is a futility, an emptiness, which is done upon the earth. That there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. Yeah. What he's saying is, I have observed that what do we have here in the West? Back where I came from, we had the numbers racket. So if he were writing this back where I was raised when I was a kid, he would say, I have observed that the numbers racketeers have the biggest houses in town and are very well to do. And I have observed that the faithful church attenders have it rough. Out here in the West, he might say, I have observed that the bookies for the racetrack. Do we have bookies in Denver for the racetracks? Illegal betting? Oh. I have observed that, I better not mention any names here, I might get sued for libel. I have observed that the prostitutes seem to be well off. And the pimps that work with the prostitutes, they dress kind of flashy, kind of nice. Where those who are righteous sometimes are in tatters and rags. I have observed that the wicked are fat when the righteous should be fat. Okay. Well, I shouldn't have brought that illustration. So he comes to a conclusion on the basis of this. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said, this also is vanity. What he's not considering is that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. That many of the things that God sends to the earth, they hit the just and the unjust. But he isn't considering this. So in view of this, in verse 15, he comes to his conclusion about this eating and drinking. Then I commended mirth. I said, well, let's just quit worrying about it and just be happy. I praise mirth. Because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. Now there is the key. The problem is that Solomon is reasoning under the sun. He is reasoning from human experience. Now granted, it's good to eat. It's good to drink. It's good to be happy. The issue is, what is the basis of true happiness? And Solomon can't seem to discover that in his book. And so, because there is little satisfaction for men beyond pleasure, he should enjoy this because this is the fruit of his labor. So he says, then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. For that shall abide him of his labor, the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun, as though nothing else is abiding. As there are no deeper relationships in life that abide. As there are no deeper values in life. He is back to his old conclusion. He is none the better for all the wisdom that he has. He's still giving that same conclusion that he had earlier in the book. Now he confesses to this somewhat in the next two verses. They are part of very much a part of the end of this chapter too. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that, too many words here, for also neither day or night see asleep with his eyes, that a person gets so involved with this he couldn't sleep. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. And the work that he has in mind there is the work of God under the sun. And he is making confession in verse 17 that though a man is wise from human viewpoint, he may be even looked upon as a good civil leader from human viewpoint. He may have common sense and practical judgment and be a good ruler. Even though a man be wise under the sun, he cannot find out all the work that God has done under the sun. And a wise man who strives to know finds himself in the dark about the deepest mysteries of life, like who am I, what am I doing here, and where am I going? There is only one answer to those questions, and that is the answer that God gives in Revelation. God has to tell us who we are, what we are doing here, and where we are going. And around that revolves the issues of life. Now, in this book, Solomon will never get to that. He can't hit it. It's beyond him. Because he is functioning with human wisdom under the sun, separated from God. So he says, verse 17, his conclusion. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, farther, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it or to discover it. In other words, it is beyond what natural revelation, what human understanding at its best can come to under the sun. Solomon is simply saying in verse 17, he is saying, a man at his best, a wise man, see, and a wise man, as we've noticed, has certain advantages in this book over all other men. Solomon is extolling this person. But a man at his best, a wise man, cannot resolve the mysteries of life on his own. He'll come up with the wrong conclusions. He'll say that death ends it all. He'll say that the best we can have in life is have fun, and so he becomes a hedonist, follows that for a while and finds that that fails him, follows something else, and he just jostles back and forth. He comes to the end of his life and he says, I don't know what it's all about. He cannot resolve the issues and the mysteries of life on his own. This whole theme of the book, then, is an argument for the necessity of divine revelation. And that, of course, is what God claims to give us in the person of Christ and in His Word. Okay? Okay, now we should learn something about our Bibles from this sort of vein that Solomon is in. The Bible does not always express divine viewpoint. The way you establish whether the Bible is expressing divine viewpoint is that you establish what it is saying in the mouth of two or three witnesses within the Bible. In other words, there'll be reaffirmation of the truth somewhere in the Bible. Solomon is going to come to some very false conclusions. Look at chapter 9, for example, in verses 4 and 5, where he talks about death, which is his big hang-up in the book. He says in verse 4 of chapter 9, "For to him that is joined to all the living there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion." Now, a lion, of course, was majestic. It had an aura about it. It was a princely animal, at least in Solomon's eyes. They seem like kind of vagabonds to me, and ruffians. They're not even very, except the female lion. The female lion is something to behold. But the male lion is a lazy, indignant, not much to observe. But a dog, an unclean animal, in Solomon's day, a living dog was better than a dead lion. A dead lion held a certain aura. Why does he say that? Verse 5, "For the living know that they shall die, but the dead do not know anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun." Comes back to the same conclusion, because that's true. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, drink thy wine with a merry heart. Have a good time. Because it's all going to end. Some people base the doctrine of total annihilation on those two verses. And they say, see, the Bible speaks for the unsaved people a total annihilation. Nothing known after the grave, after physical death. And for a believer, there is soul sleep. Well, that's contradictory to what the New Testament says. Even if the story of the rich man and Lazarus is a parable, it still contradicts it. This makes death annihilation. In annihilation, the rich man lifted up his eyes to God. He was in torment. So in annihilation, he's lifting up his eyes. He's asking someone to come and quench his thirst. Solomon comes to a false conclusion because he's utilizing only human viewpoint in this book. The Bible does not always express divine viewpoint. The Bible contains divine viewpoint, human viewpoint, and satanic viewpoint. Now, the way you reaffirm divine viewpoint in the Bible is in the mouth of two or three witnesses. When the Bible states that a man or Satan says something, you can rest assured that man or Satan said that thing. But the truth of that thing must be measured by the rest of Scripture. Okay. Solomon is of that category. Let everything be established in the mouth of two or three witnesses, and you will not be able to establish some of the conclusions that he comes to, because he's coming to conclusions based upon what he has observed in his affairs with men under the sun, the best that the human mind could do under the sun. Any questions about that? Okay, let me show you something about chapter 9. In chapter 9, he continues to make these conclusions based upon human viewpoint. And he gets back on his subject of death. Okay? And in chapter 9, verses 1 through 6, he is going to deal with the one common fate, this thing that sort of bugs him. The one common fate of all, and that is death or the grave. And this throws him a curve. For all this I considered in my heart. His heart, of course, is his frame of reference, his computer of his mind. Even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred. Now leave out the supplied words. All before them, or all is before them. Man that cannot tell what he will love or what he will hate. It's all before him. And he may find himself in the future hating what he loved in the past and loving what he hated in the past. It's all before him. He cannot predict. He cannot tell what he will love or hate. Verse 2. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked. He's making a contrast here now, but there's one event that comes to these people. Here's a righteous person and a wicked person. There is one event that comes to them. To the good and the clean. Here's good, clean, here's the unclean. To them, there's one event coming. To him that sacrifices and to him that refuses to sacrifice, there's one event coming. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath. This is an evil among all the things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. For to him that is joined to all the living there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they shall die, that's the one event. But the dead know not anything, neither have they any more reward. For the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything under the sun. And the main idea in this passage is that death ends all. It is the one common end of all. And he sees this as an evil. Now, of course, information he's given there contradicts Luke 16, contradicts what Paul says in Philippians in a number of places, contradicts what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Not that way at all. Now, because he is thinking falsely, then he comes to a false conclusion, the same one again in verse 7. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now, while you're living, accepts thy works. What he is saying in chapter 9 And verses 7 through 10 is this: due to our common faith, due to our common faith, this death, make the best of life. Make the best of life. Eat, drink, be happy. Verse 8, let thy garments be always white. Let thy head lack no ointment. Dress well. Live joyously. Verse 9, live joyfully with thy wife, whom thou lovest, all the days of the life of your emptiness, which he has given thee under the sun, all the days of thy futility, thy vanity. For that is the portion in this life. All right. In other words, he's saying vanity or is your portion in this life, and then when this life ends, it's all over with. And in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Or the best that you can have in this life, the best portion that you can have in this life is to live joyfully. Well, you follow his advice in this book, it doesn't sound like it's too much fun. In fact, he's having some real problems. Verse 10. Enter into everything energetically. Whatsoever your hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in Sheol, where you're going. Everything you're going to do, do in this life. Well, that's the information in that verse happens to be true. You're not going to do things in your next life that's going to add meaning to this life. Okay. In verses 11 and 12, he tells us that the time of death is uncertain. I returned, and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. But time and chance happeneth to them all. For man also knoweth not his time. It means his time of death. As the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in a snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them. And he is talking about the fact that the time of death is a great uncertainty. Okay. He cannot solve the riddle of life. And he will not solve it for us in Ecclesiastes. We have already seen the best that he's going to come up with. And that is, try to live a happy life despite all the futility and vanity that's going on around about you. The rest of this chapter is best understood with chapter 10. And so we're going to do it next week. Okay? If I can answer any questions, I'd like to try to do so now, if you have any, about what we said. I can't wait to get finished with this book. It's driving me crazy. It uses the word Hebel. He uses the word Hebel 29 times in 12 chapters. That means almost 2.5 times for each chapter. And the word Hebel means empty, futile, meaningless, fruitlessness. It's a very, very negative word. It just keeps coming at us and at us and at us with it. Until finally I'm about half out of my mind after spending about 12 hours a week in this book. Drives me batty. And I'm in a hurry to get out. No questions. Okay, next week, come back, and we're going to see what other futility this man is dealing with under the sun. Shall we close in prayer? Father, help us to appreciate that your word in Ecclesiastes is reinforcing our need for divine revelation. And in view of this futile attitude of life that Solomon, a decadent Old Testament believer, but nevertheless a believer, has been brought to, a certain hopelessness in life that causes him to be totally negative and confused, a wandering, meaningless, purposeless believer. And help us in the light of this vivid illustration of what can happen to a believer to appreciate more your word, what you've told us,
about life and the meaningful relationships in life. Help us to appreciate them more and identify more with what your word is saying as the meaningful life, we pray in Christ's name. Thanksgiving. Amen.